I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Amid the climate crisis, groups around the world have sprouted up as advocates for the environment. They're concerned with shrinking polar ice caps, CO2 emissions, and so much more. But is the movement as inclusive as it should be? Today, why environmentalism seems focused on middle-class white folks and fails to connect with young people of color. We'll learn of some organizations working toward a more encompassing approach. Then, the miraculous life cycle of the emperor penguin, a species that thrives in the harshest environment on Earth. We'll meet the man who spent a year in Antarctica documenting them. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. There are no environmental organizations in Kansas or Missouri led by people of color, and while there are many groups in our region and around the nation dedicated to sustainability and protecting the environment, Angelo Isolo says the movement is flawed and that it fails to connect the use of color. All this comes as the UN Environment Program is reporting today that its outlook for climate change was bleak. Countries have failed to stop the growth in global greenhouse emissions, meaning that deeper and faster cuts are now required. Angelo Isolo is the author of Engage, Connect, Protect, Empowering Diverse Youth as Environmental Leaders. She's the founder and CEO of the Greening Youth Foundation. She joins us now from WABE in Atlanta. Angelo, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're also joined in studio here with John Gordon. He's the founder of Boys Grow in Kansas City, Missouri. That's a group that connects inner city boys to jobs on farms. John, nice to have you too. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Angelo, you lay it all out in your book. Young people of color are often left out of the conversation when it comes to protecting the environment. I'm wondering why.
Yeah, I mean, that's a question that I've been pondering for quite some time. And I even think back to when I was a young girl, having a lot of interest in the environment, or at least the outdoors, loving nature, and growing up in Jersey City, New Jersey. It wasn't necessarily being an environmentalist or any career in the environment or green sector, what have you, was not necessarily something that was put before me as a career pathway, not even by my parents. So, you know, now that I'm 48 and doing this work, I have recently asked them, and they said that it wasn't necessarily something that they saw as a area or career that was safe or for their little girl, or something that they felt comfortable with, because they simply didn't see anybody that looked like them or looked like me in the field. And I'm just really worried about that that myth being perpetuated. You know, obviously back in the 70s, I could understand it, but there's no reason at all why, you know, it's such it's so homogeneous in the field right now. And I often say, I liken it to Chimamanda's and Ngozi's danger of a single narrative, because I think if we continually say that there's a certain prototype or a type person that should be working or even recreating in the outdoors and working in natural resource management, that we're just going to keep believing it. And young people that are coming up, and if they don't see themselves in these fields or out in the outdoors, then they're simply not going to think that they should be there. So, you know, I'm very happy. I'm sorry, Steve, but just excited to be trying to change that myth.
John Gordon, again, founder of Boys Grow in Kansas City. You've been doing this for a number of years now, John. Can you explain this misconception in society about who cares and who knows about the environment?
I mean, I know some of the boys that come into our program don't necessarily have the opportunity to do a lot of outdoor activities. So, you know, our farm is within Kansas City limits, but we still sit on 10 acres. So just taking them fishing and doing a variety of things that you might not have the opportunity to do. So in our experience, you know, if you enjoy doing something and you love it, you'll respect it more.
You know, Angelo, you also talk about the historical connotation that Black people have with the outdoors and how it's long been associated with fear. This has led, you know, to a modern message that the outdoors, you know, things like national parks and camping and hiking are not for Black people. Elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, there obviously is a history there of the outdoors being a scary place, you know, and there have been, you know, grandparents and great grandparents that had tell stories of what happens in the outdoors. But there, I'm happy and I'm really wanting to share, you know, with the broader public that, as John has said, that is changing and that, you know, people of color are really connected to the outdoors and are seeing it as a place where not only are they enjoying it and understanding that it's a good place for health reasons, but are also looking to the outdoors as a place for working and so forth. So it's really important to change that narrative of who could be out there and remove some of the stigma as to, you know, what happened in the past.
You know, John, you've clearly caught on to this issue of young people not engaging with the environment here in Kansas City. Tell us a little more about Boys Grow. Again, you provide jobs to inner city boys on farms where they're growing their own food, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, the mission is entrepreneurism through agriculture. So our mission statement is entrepreneurial based. But as we've grown and evolved, we've realized we got a captive audience that enjoys what they're doing. So we've been able to teach them a variety of things from, you know, vocational training, mentorship, a variety of things. And one of those things has been, you know, to put it simply, just being good stewards of the lands and kind of what that means on the broader sense.
What percentage of the boys you take about 40 each year, what percentage of them are lit up by the opportunity that you give them?
Lit up is a great way to put it. I'd say 100%.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they enjoy working. We pay them, so they get paid. So that's a nice thing, but they all love it. They honestly do. I mean, it's any job, there's going to be trials and tribulations, but for the most part, our graduation rate is great and the kids really do enjoy what they're doing.
But why is it so important for young boys in your program to learn about fresh food the way they do? Working the way they do.
Yeah, it's just kind of it's evolved as a byproduct of our program. Entrepreneurism is how we started, and then we quickly realized that the kids actually really did enjoy learning about fresh food and what organic food and good food tastes like. So that's just kind of something that's evolved into what we do. You know, we grow on 10 acres. So, and all the food that the boys consume throughout the summer program in particular is all grown on the farm. So they have a hand in every aspect of it.
So the impact on them is what? What do they walk away with?
Well, they're going to walk away with a lot of good food, right? And vocational training. So we have a construction program, culinary arts, graphic design, public speaking. So we run a small business. So each kid will have 2 years of kind of a working paid internship on those variety of fields. So if they want to go into that, they can. And one of the things that we've been able to kind of add in the last year or two is this kind of stewardship of the land, environmental protection, et cetera, et cetera. So there's an elements of our program we've been able to build based on some new construction we have going on now and some other aspects of the program.
But just based on my own experience, young boys don't like vegetables. How do you get them over that hump?
Well, you pair it with some pork and they're going to eat some kale.
When they're hungry, they'll eat it, right?
Yeah,
there you go. Angelo, what kinds of changes can be made in classrooms across the country to engage young people of color to become better environmental stewards? What do you think needs to happen?
Sure. But I just would love to say that I love what John is doing.
Yeah, no kidding.
With Boys Grow. I mean, it's amazing when you put access and opportunity together. The sky is the limit. And it sounds like that's what's happening with the young men that he's working with. I would say that the classes and the schools just need to really make sure that the material that they teach is culturally relevant. You know, so it's one thing to put some environmental education, environmental literacy material before the urban young people. But to make it to meet them where they are and to make it really resonate with them. There are some nuances to that material, and I certainly provide an example of that in my book, Engage, Connect, Protect, as it relates to air quality and teaching about, you know, asthma and things that affect them in their community. But I'm sure John would even agree that, you know, when you're looking at material and how to make it really connect and engage the young people that you're working with, it has to be tailored to your audience. It has to be tailored to the people that you're trying to reach.
Mm-hmm. Because you make a point of saying that if young people are miserable after they get in the door, we're not doing anybody any favors. What do you mean by that?
I mean, if this material, well, first of all, I mean, it's all so intersectional. So it's really hard to just, when we first started, Ruth Kitchen, who worked on this environmental education program with me, we just went in and our focus was just environmental education. And there's just no way to go into, you know, an urban school and just have that be the focus without seeing all these other issues affecting the community, affecting the families, affecting the young people. So you have to start bringing in, you know, wellness and other things. So that's exactly what we did. So in order for us to move this work forward and to really have it be broadened and received by various communities, you have to view it from various perspectives. So you have to view it from access equity and underemployment, unemployment. As John said, you know, the fact that he's paying these young men really means a lot. You know, we would love to say that, you know, they're just volunteering and this is just something great that they're doing, and that, you know, they want to do this from the goodness of their hearts. The truth of the matter is that there are so many issues plaguing communities of color. And one of them is employment and underemployment. So the fact that he's able to pay them for this experience, it does mean a lot, and it does ring home for them.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about ways to connect young people of color to the environmental movement and the lack of leadership of involving people of color in environmental organizations in both Kansas and Missouri. If you want to join our conversation, our number 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. John, how difficult is it to create a successful working environment out at Boys Grow?
It's taken time, you know. Mm-hmm. There's a, like any workplace or any youth program in particular, there's going to be a culture, and that takes time to build. And you got to let that happen organically on a lot of levels. You can't control it too much, but you can kind of, you know, control the content to an extent. Ours is a 2-year program, so hopefully our older boys are mentored well by the younger boys are mentored, and then when they become the mentors, so it's kind of a cycle. So, you know, it's it can be difficult. I mean, working with 14 to 16 year olds outside when it's 100 degrees and mm-hmm. they're doing stuff they're not familiar with doing. You know, so we try to keep it engaging and educational, but also light and fun. And, you know, and similar to what Angela was saying, the content on how you kind of broadcast a message and the way you do it is super important. So
how do people connect with the organization? If you want to be one of those 40 young people, how do they get involved?
You just go to the website. We start mm-hmm. recruiting in March.
Do you have any trouble getting a complement of 40 each year?
You know, not really.
Yeah,
but we want to make sure we get the right kids.
You know?
It's a 2-year commitment, so that's mm-hmm. that's a long time for that age.
Yeah, you recently started construction of a new multi-purpose building for Boys Grow, which will be 90% more eco-friendly than standard construction. You call it a passive build. What does that mean, and why have you chosen to go this route, John?
Passive build is it's based off German engineering, and it yields 90% more eco-friendly, mainly in regards to energy output, compared to your traditional build.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to do this for a lot of reasons, partly because it gels well with our mission, right? Mm-hmm. So we're teaching our young guys to be good stewards of the land, and we figure we might as well build something that is extremely unique in the area, and there's really no other commercial passive house builds in the area anywhere. So we thought it'd be a great opportunity to partner with kind of a newer up-and-coming construction company
yeah.
with a prior design build and build something really, really unique that will serve serve our youth, but then also have the opportunity to have other organizations, corporate board retreats, or whatever it might be, to come out, enjoy the facility, learn about Boys Grow, taste organic food, and let the young guys have the opportunity to learn a very unique way of building and learn it hands-on. So the kids are able to actually do some of this work. So it's complicated construction. Any construction is complicated, but this is a whole nother level. So for folks to come out and take a tour on what a passive building is and have our young folks kind of be the ambassadors and see it from when it starts to when it's finished,
yeah,
that has value in it right there.
Angelo, you wanted to hop in here a minute ago and I cut you off. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, I just, again, just love what he's doing. And Greeny Youth Foundation has a similar program called our Urban Youth Corps program. And that's when we focus on young people between the ages of 17 and 25. And it's kind of, there was an evolution. So I love that it's a 2-year program, John. When we first started doing our Urban Youth Corps program, we were providing them with training. So it's like a traditional training program in a lot of kind of green fields, hands-on fields as well. But it was just a training. And then at the end, we realized that there were not a lot of jobs for them waiting at the end of the training. So this program has now evolved into the point where they're with us for a year. So we are training them in areas like solar panel installation, rain barrel installation, landscape management. They're doing streetscapes and tree care management and prescribed burn crews. And the beauty is, and then, you know, there's soft skills that we're giving them as well. So we're teaching them about financial literacy, life coaching, and professional development. And the goal at this point, and I like that John said, it's entrepreneurial focused, because what we're doing is, you know, there may not be jobs waiting for them. And in some cases there are, and we're picking fields that have employers that are looking for employees where, you know, fields where they are looking for a workforce where there's a shortage. But due to the entrepreneurial skills that we're giving them, they're learning that they can too start businesses in these fields. So that's the one thing that I love that I hear John is saying, and we certainly have done the same thing. There have been businesses born out of this Urban Youth Corps program, and therefore they're taking their future into their own hands. I mean, it's not easy,
right?
You know, but when they're going, and then the beauty of having them for an entire year is that the bonds that they form with one another are great. Mm-hmm. It gives us an opportunity to undo some of those bad habits and teach them conflict resolution, how to make better decisions.
That's interesting.
You know, it's really hard. So the attrition isn't as bad. Even when they do go to these different employer partners to work and have jobs, it's not as bad in terms of them, you know, understanding how to keep a job and what to do.
I was really struck, Angelo, by something you said a minute ago. Why are companies having a hard time connecting to people of color? Because, again, the jobless rate is so high in the inner city. What's the issue there in terms of connecting companies with these people?
That is the question of the hour, Steve, because it's like, to me, that's one of the things I address in this book. You know, on one hand, you know, and I feel like I'm in both of these worlds because I can see and I hear from a lot of these employers in this environmental field saying, oh my gosh, we need a workforce. We need people. Like when you look at the National Park Service, Forest Service, a lot of these federal land management agencies, they're actually calling it the silver tsunami because people are retiring at alarming rates. So they're really needing a workforce. And this is also in tree care management. I can, like, the list goes on and on. And then on the other side, like, I'm an African-American woman, so I have a lot of access and through church and different communities that I'm a part of. I see that there's so much under and unemployment as it relates to Black and brown youth, Native American youth. So I'm like, what is going on? Why can't these two things be put together? And that's exactly what we've been doing at Greeny Youth Foundation for the past 14 years is really bringing those two worlds together. But we're still, you know, when you look at the outdoor retail industry, outdoor recreation, we're still answering that question. We have these young people here. Let's put them together so that we can help solve some of these environmental issues plaguing our society.
John, do you have any better insight into that? Why companies are having a hard time connecting to people of color?
I don't know if I have some serious insight to that.
But it's an issue, right? I mean, there's something that's not quite connecting here.
Yeah. I believe so. I don't have any serious insights to that. I know that we're trying to build resumes and build soft skills and build a variety of things to assist with that.
Yeah. You know, Angelo, you talk about the dangers of shutting out entire groups of people in the conversation about sustainability. The dangers there would be what?
Well, it's dangerous because, for various reasons, but one of the ones that really is probably the loudest to me is that communities of color are so vulnerable and are on the front line of, I say, you know, the first to be affected by climate change and a lot of the, whether it's flooding or a lot of these crises that we're seeing in the environmental sector. Now, so I think that if they're not activists and they're not engaged, if they're seeing this as something, these issues as something for someone else to work on, someone else to solve, that's a problem. Like, we need, and then conversely, you know, majority, the folks that are in those environmental spaces, they can't see this as something that they can do alone, you know, that We're not at a time now we can say, okay, this group can work on this issue, this group can't. It really has to be all hands on deck.
Yeah,
I think if we can't move to that, you know, then it really is a scary time.
John, I wanted to go back to something you said earlier too. This idea of how you make it fun to work outside when it's 100 degrees out there. What's the magic trick? How do you do that? How do you motivate people to work in that kind of heat?
We have a pond, so we let them go swimming.
Yeah, that helps.
Yeah. So there's a variety of things, but at the end of the day, it just trickles down to whether they want to be there. Mm-hmm. You know, so do they want to be there? Is this something they believe in? Something they value? Something they enjoy? And you know, there's a whole lot of things that can go into making them be a part of that. But there's not necessarily one thing in particular.
I was going to say, if so much of this is new to them or relatively new to them, how do they know if they're going to enjoy it or not?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, that's why we actually interview the kids one-on-one. We sit down. They have to have referrals from guardians and you know, and teachers. So we try to kind of vet them to make sure they want to be a part of this.
Mm-hmm. And that gets you through then, eh?
Yeah, for the most part.
Yeah. So as we leave this conversation, Angelo, how hopeful are you for the future of the environmental movement? And are we heading the right way, or what do you think?
I am hopeful, and I before I forget, I just want to say that I'm really excited. I'm going to be at the Lawrence Public Library, so I'll be in the Kansas area February 20th. So I would love to meet you, John, and I hope others will come out to kind of hear more about what we're talking about here.
You bet, that's great.
But I am very hopeful. I am hopeful because there are so many. I mean, the numbers are perhaps bleak in terms of people of color at C-suites, and you know, there's all sorts of reports that are showing that we're not up at that level. But there are many organizations that are led by people of color or working with communities of color doing this work and really engaging this next generation of environmental leaders, and they happen to be people of color. So I'm very hopeful, you know, through the work that we do and I see every day. You asked John about, you know, how hard is it to get people to apply for these opportunities? I mean, when we put out, you know, opportunities and job postings, whether it's for our internships or is it for our Urban Youth Corps program, we get hundreds of applications. So the word is getting out that, you know, this is a great field to work in. It makes you feel good. And it's also, you know, could be a great way to make a living, you know. So I'm very hopeful.
John,
thank you for that question.
Yeah. How optimistic are you, John?
I mean, we're optimistic on what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we take it on kind of a micro level, and you know, we grow we have 10 acres and we have another 20 acres. We're doing an eco restoration project with Heartland Conservation, EPA, National Fish and Wildlife.
Well, what part of the city is your 10 acres in?
In South Kansas City, kind of South Grandview. Mm-hmm. And then our other 20 acres is right by the stadiums off Blue River.
No kidding.
So, you know, I mean, on the micro level, we got a kind of an army of young guys that care what they're doing. And when people come to tour the farm, they're excited to tell them that they're not using pesticides and things like that.
Right. We have a phone call here from Carl from Kansas City, Missouri. Carl, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. John, interested in what you're doing with kids. And with the screener, I left the opportunity for you to get some thornless blackberry bushes from me if you want them. So she has that information if you'd like.
Excellent. Thank you.
That's great,
also,
Carol. Yeah, go ahead.
There's 364 acres in Swope Park that used to be the outdoor school. It's not used for that anymore, and I wonder if the park board would be open to using some of the hilltops for that land for some of your projects with the guys.
Sounds like sounds like a collaboration with our comrades down in Georgia.
Yeah.
Okay.
That sounds good.
John, I want a tour.
Yeah, you bet.
Thanks for the call, Carl. I appreciate it. I want to thank our good guests here. Angelo Isolo is the author of Engage, Connect, Protect, Empowering Diverse Youth as Environmental Leaders. She's the founder and CEO of the Greening Youth Foundation. We were also joined here by John Gordon, the founder of Boys Grow in Kansas City. Thank you both for a good conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much, Steve.
You bet.
And John, I want that tour.
All right. February 13th.
Sounds good. After a short break, when we come back, we'll talk about the March of the Emperor Penguin. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you haven't subscribed to Kraske Off Mic, then you missed the legend of Steve Kraske, Baby Whisperer. My weekly newsletter offers behind-the-scenes extras and my musings on up-to-date topics. You can get all that in Kraske Off Mic every Monday in your inbox. Sign up at kcur.org/Kraske and start enjoying. It's quick and easy. kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow, as part of KCUR's look at climate change, two area teachers discuss how the topic is taught in their classrooms, hear about the social hurdles they have to clear, and the education standards that guide them Wednesday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, sometimes a job calls for extraordinary effort, even if that means working in 60 below zero temperatures, ice sheets, and the most brutal winter on the planet, all in the name of shooting footage of the Emperor Penguin. A natural history cameraman, Lindsay McRae, got the assignment of shooting that footage, and he did so for 337 consecutive days. It meant missing the birth of his son, Walter. The finished project won awards as part of the acclaimed BBC series Dynasties that was narrated by Sir David Attenborough. It also resulted in a new book, My Penguin Year, Life Among the Emperors, that's now out. Lindsay McRae joins us via Skype from the Lake District in England. Lindsay, good morning. Nice to have you.
Hello. Oh, I was going to say good evening, but it is good morning over there.
It's still good morning. It's good evening where you are, I think. Yeah, yeah.
Well, a very dark and wet one.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. Yes. You've wanted to be a nature photographer since you were a little boy. Why?
Well, I grew up in the Lake District, and it's a beautiful area in the north of England with lots of lakes and lots of high mountains, and it's on the coast, and it's just heaving with wildlife. And I think, like most youngsters, I was fascinated by the natural world, and that's never left me.
I was going to say, you started off filming a family of badgers near your home as a little boy. How did you come across them?
Well, I just spent every minute I could of every day outside. It's where I was my happiest. And it was just the perfect subject to spend time with.
It led to your first photography gig. What happened there?
Well, I actually made a film with the BBC when I was 13. And that was my first exposure really to professional kit, to cameras. I had no experience prior to that. I was just madly into the natural world. And made a few contacts, and it sort of just spiraled from there, really.
Hmm. You also have a longstanding interest in shooting in Antarctica. It dates back again to your childhood. Where does that come from?
Well, I remember watching vividly the first Planet Earth, and I was only a young teenager at the time. The extremities that the film crew were having up with, being as far away from home as I could be, working in the most brutal conditions I'd probably ever experienced, all those things excited me. And it was obviously seeing an emperor penguin as well. It's an animal that everybody knows what one looks like.
Mm-hmm.
It just became my dream.
How did you wind up getting this particular assignment to shoot for the Dynasties BBC series?
I don't know. You'll have to ask my producers. But I just basically got a phone call saying, would you like to go and film Emperors in Antarctica? And obviously I was, wow, yes, please. However, the catch was, I would have to spend 11 months down there. So from the end of February through to the beginning of November, the Antarctic winter, the weather is so unpredictable that to film during that period, you have to stay. There's no way in, there's no way out. During this time is when the majority of the penguins' breeding process happens. So we had to be there for that time.
Did you have any idea what you were really getting yourself into here?
No, not really. All that I had in my mind was spending time in this beautiful landscape with the most charismatic animal on the planet. I didn't really think of much else. But obviously, as time moved forward and we did all our training and preparatory work, and obviously I had family, and it did start to hit home that I was disappearing for almost a year. And yeah, it got tough at times, if I'm honest.
You know, I've lived in Minnesota, so I know something about cold, but you write about shooting in 35 below Celsius temperatures, so cold that you write in the book that it actually hurt. Describe that kind of cold to us.
Well, it's funny. I haven't experienced anything like that. I think the lowest I'd got to was minus 15 prior to Antarctica. And we arrived in the summer where temperatures were averaging around minus 5, which were easy. No gloves, no hats. We very quickly got used to that. But I remember our first day at minus 35, and anything to minus 25 is fine, but you start getting minus 30 and below, and that's when it's really, really cold. And during the middle of winter, we were averaging minus 40 and below, and it's very, I mean, I even now find it difficult to remember what that felt like, but I remember sitting on the ice, trying to do my job, and just everything hurting.
Well, people here are hearing you say that you could walk around without hat and gloves when it was 5 below 0. That would seem like a stretch to me, hearing you say that.
Yeah, and it was a surprise to me, but I very, very quickly, my body got used to those conditions. And a bit of sun in the summer and you were all right. But as soon as autumn hit, and we lost the sun as well for 2 months in the winter. Mm-hmm. And not that the sun does give you any heat in the autumn or the spring, but when it does drop below the horizon, you really do feel the difference. And yeah, that's when we were hitting minus 45 and below regularly.
You know, there are photographs in the book of you filming with your equipment when it's that cold out, 40 degrees below zero. How in the world does your equipment work when it's that cold outside?
It blew my mind how our kit carried on going. We did some testing in a facility in the UK where we put our cameras into a freezer room and dropped the temperature to minus 40. And we got a good idea of what would work at those temperatures. However, you can't replicate the conditions until you get down there. So you've got the wind to battle against. You've got drifting snow, so tiny little ice particles that are blowing into the inside of the camera. So I'd tape up all the air vents. There was all sorts of battery modifications we had to make. Little rubber buttons would freeze solid, so I wouldn't be able to press them. So we'd turn those into plastic ones, we'd replace them. Huh. I'd stick 4 batteries on my back and stuff them down my clothes and put a cable into the back of the camera rather than having to power it by an external battery. So every day was a learning curve. And I think even by the end of it, we hadn't quite mastered everything. But I loved the challenge of going out every day and learning something new.
I was going to say, you write in the book that you couldn't even bring the equipment inside out of the cold because you were worried that the change in temperature would wind up cracking the equipment, cracking the lens. Did that ever happen?
Well, no. I mean, I think I only brought the cameras in maybe 3 or 4 times across the whole year. And you're probably talking, say, minus 40 outside plus 20 inside. So a 60 degree difference in temperature, degrees Celsius. And you obviously can't just do that because everything would shatter and condensation would just kill the kit. So the occasions I did bring the kit inside, it would take me 4 or 5 days to slowly get it up to temperature. But the rest of the time, it just sat in an airtight box on the back of my skidoo outside.
Hmm. We're visiting with Lindsay McRae, who joins us from Skype from the Lake District in England, about his new book, My Penguin Year, Life Among the Emperors. That book is now out. Why was the BBC so interested in emperor penguins, Lindsay?
Well, the whole series, the Dynasty series, was very different to the sort of standard format of natural history television. In like Blue Planet and the Planet Earth, the previous Planet Earth, little sort of 5-minute sequences jump around the Earth, capturing different pieces of behavior from different creatures and a key moment. But what Dynasties wanted to do was follow an individual animal family or group of animals. And for the series, they chose a variety of animals from tigers to wild dogs and chimpanzees, and emperor penguins was one of those species. And I think that the five species that were chosen, they are the most charismatic on the planet. And I was the one lucky enough to be given that job of making the emperor film.
I was really struck as you read through the book. You really, when you were down there, you really got a sense of the different personalities of the individual animals that you hung out with. Describe some of that to us.
Well, it's funny because with the other programs, they were following individuals, set individuals that they would follow. Obviously, we had a colony of 11,000 emperors that all looked identical. So our film was our family was the entire colony and those guys living together. But they're incredibly gentle. They're incredibly, what's the word? Their bonds together are so strong. And just being able to see that firsthand, they know that they rely on each other to survive down there. And it's very clear to see when you're sat in amongst them.
No other animal breeds in an environment that's as harsh as this one. Not even polar bears, Lindsay?
Well, polar bears are in the Arctic, in the northern hemisphere.
That's right.
There's nothing in the Antarctic. The emperors are the only ones. Weddell seals also breed through the winter in Antarctica, but everything else disappears north to flee the weather. And that's one of the reasons why the emperors breed through the winter, because they have no predators. But on the other hand, the weather's their big predator, and that's the one huge thing that they have to overcome.
It's so interesting to me that it's the males who wind up incubating the eggs. How unusual in nature is that?
Yeah, very unusual. It's almost complete role reversal with emperors. It's funny, I was determined to try and find a visual difference between males and females because I knew that there wasn't one. But spending so much time with them, I thought I may be able to spot something here, but I couldn't. However, at certain times of the year, so when the females are just about to lay their eggs, it's taken a huge toll on their body and they're really thin, whereas the males are still prepared for the next 60 days and the whole winter incubating this egg. So they're still big and fat and regal looking. The females lay their eggs, they hand the male the eggs and then they disappear, and that's them gone for the whole of winter. They go back to sea and feed, and it's the males that huddle together and do all the work. And it's amazing that the females turn up almost to the day when their eggs hatch. It's an absolute miracle. It was incredible.
Speaking of incredible, describe for us the moment you realized the females were returning, because again, it was such a remarkable moment and you describe it so well in the book.
We'd had quite a big storm over the period of time that we were expecting eggs to hatch. We got back down to the colony and it was a complete and utter change from the last. So I think we'd been away from the birds maybe 4 or 5 days. We'd been unable to get to them. And we'd left the huddle of males almost silent. They've got no reason to call during this period. They're just focusing on saving as much energy as possible. And we returned to the colony and it was just deafening. There were birds calling everywhere. And in amongst these birds calling were chicks. You could hear that a lot of chicks had started to hatch. And yeah, in the distance and appearing very fast, just hundreds of females had coincided their return with the first of the chicks. So it was an incredible day. And for the next week or two, there was just long lines of birds returning and that was the females coming back. And they looked incredible. They'd obviously spent 2 months at sea feeding and fattening up. And they were just the most stunning individuals when they returned into the colony.
You know, in that commotion, I think you actually witnessed a kidnapping. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, kidnapping was on our shopping list, if you like. It is known behavior with penguins. They've got such a strong maternal instinct that even if they lose their chick or their egg, they still want to be able to succeed in that breeding season. And it was something we wanted to see, but to be honest, never expected to see. And the first couple of penguins, the first real couple, so their chick had hatched, the male had it, the female had returned, and they were just in the process of, the male was just in the process of passing the chick to the female. And an emperor that must have either lost its egg or lost its chick spotted the ice, and it just, as soon as it left the feet of the male, this adult emperor just jumped on it, trying to kidnap it. And that attracted a lot of other emperors. And for maybe a minute, there was just this mad commotion. And I remember following the chick on the ground with my camera. This all happened right in front of me. And then all of a sudden, this bird waddled towards me with a chick on its feet, and the mayhem sort of subsided. And what was left were the original pair, but without the chick. And the chances of that chick surviving, nobody really knows. But but it was quite sad because that pair had worked, you know, through incredible circumstances to get the chick to that age, and then all of a sudden they had absolutely nothing to show for it.
How did the emperors react to having you around with your camera all the time?
Well, a lot of those emperor penguins had probably never seen a human being before, so they have no reason to be scared of us. Just to give you an idea of size, emperors are big birds, and if I knelt down, one would look me in the eye. They're up to 4 foot tall. They're huge. And we obviously had certain rules to follow when we were down there. We weren't allowed within a certain distance of the huddle. However, you'd set your camera up every day and you'd turn around and you'd have three or four birds lying down asleep next to you. They just loved our company, and obviously we loved theirs. And very, very friendly and not scared at all.
Yeah. Let me go to a phone call here. Florence from Kansas City, Kansas. Florence, you're on the Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning, guest. And so, Steve, my question is, first I'd like to share, I love the magnificent emperor penguin. I want them in the future for my great-grandchildren to enjoy. I have great-grandchildren. I want them to be around. I want to get that book and give it to my great-grandchildren. The question for the guest is, how are climate changes in the Arctic affecting the emperor penguin? And what does he see will happen to the emperor penguin?
Yeah, what's the impact of climate change that you're noticing, Lindsay? And obviously that's a big concern going forward.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting one. Obviously, the poles are going to be the first to be hit, really, because just a slight increase in temperature down and up there, and ice will start to melt. And our colonies, the one that we filmed was okay. However, there was a big colony near the British station, Halley Bay. I think it was the second largest colony of emperors. And basically, emperors breed on a frozen ocean. So they rely on these cold temperatures to freeze the sea each winter. And then they want that ice there for as long as possible for them to lay their eggs and to bring the chicks up to a certain age where they can then swim and feed for themselves. And unfortunately, over the space of a couple of years ago, a colony of 20,000+ emperor penguins didn't manage to raise one chick simply because the ice wasn't lasting long enough. And now that colony has dispersed and is no more. They've gone elsewhere to try and find suitable ice. And I think that's a big wake-up call. It barely hit headline news here in the UK. I'm not sure about America, but it's a big sign of what can happen. And for such a well-known creature, I think a lot of people should be aware of that.
Lindsay McRae is my guest. He's a BBC cameraman who shot the Dynasty series focused on the Emperor Penguin. You know, there's an especially dramatic moment in this book, late in the book, about your decision to save a big group of emperors that had become trapped in a ravine. you really struggled with what to do here, because basically it's the job of the documentarian to observe and not to intervene. But you wound up breaking the rule here. Tell us about that moment and what you, tell us about the predicament the emperors were in when you saw them.
Well, this was mid-September, I think, and we'd been with the birds now for almost 10 months. So we were very close to the colony. We'd almost gone through everything with them. And the previous 2 weeks, I think, we'd had the most almighty storm. We'd not been able to get to the birds. We'd not been able to even open the front door of the station. The weather was that bad. And we got down to the colony, and it was just carnage. There were chicks that had separated from their parents. There were parents looking for their chicks. And then these enormous gullies and cracks in the ice where birds had been blown into. And at this point, a lot of the emperor chicks were still so young that they were relying on their parents. They were still in the brood pouch on top of their parents' feet. It was too cold for them to be independent now on the ice on their own. And yeah, it was quite a shocking sight. And what we had to do, obviously, was work out what was happening. This was something we did not expect was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And we spent a day filming what was happening and very quickly learned that birds that didn't have chicks on their feet could quite easily climb up these steep walls of ice and save themselves. But the birds that were looking after chicks weren't able to use their feet, the full movement of their legs, mm-hmm. because there was a chick sat on them. And those are the ones that were struggling to get out. And a couple of birds made a horrendous decision where they decided to leave their chick and save themselves. It was either both dying at the bottom of this gully, not being able to get out, or the chick dying and the adult saving itself. So we were actually forced back to the station for a day, bad weather again. And when we returned, the situation was no better. So we decided to help them out. And it wasn't, though, we were affecting the balance here in nature. This was a very unique situation. They hadn't been driven in there by a predator, and there were no other creatures in that part of Antarctica at this time of year that would have benefited off some dying or mm-hmm. dead penguins. And the birds at the bottom of this ravine would have only been buried anyway. So we took the decision to dig a shallow ramp in which the birds could shuffle up, and thankfully, they very quickly realized what we'd done and took advantage of it.
Oh, it's an amazing story. It's an amazing book. Lindsay McRae's book, My Penguin Year, Life Among the Emperors. He joined us via Skype this morning from the Lake District in England. Lindsay, thanks for a good conversation. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you ever so much.
Yesterday on the show, how a set of sports rivalries between Kansas City and Oakland helped put both cities in the national spotlight. You can hear that in other previous episodes. You'll find them at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow is our last show before the Thanksgiving break. We'll talk with Andy Goldsworthy again. He's the artist behind the Walking Wall exhibit, whose journey is coming to an end at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.